Captain Bauer, Reel 1. When did you join the army?
I think it must have been 1948. I left school in 1947 and went into the army with the ambition of coming to Sandhurst, as it happened, without having done a great deal of homework. But I'd been in the corps at school, and my father had been in the army, and so I had a minimal military background, as it were. And I was looking forward to getting into the army, although I knew I would have to go in any case. And so it was 48. I was a national service recruit, and as I had expressed a wish to go into the light infantry, I went to Borden, which was then the Light Infantry Brigade Training Depot. And from then, I did, I suppose, 2 weeks as a basic recruit. They had a thing in those days called the ex-cadre, and I was put into that. And then I did a... Would I have done a WASB? Would that have been right? I did a WASB and passed that, and in the fullness of time, which I suppose was something like 8 weeks, which seemed very much longer in those days, I went to Eton Hall. And I did the normal stint at Eton Hall, and I think in those days you had a choice of something like 9 regiments, my memory serves me correctly. And I was extremely fortunate to get, I think, my second choice, which was the Somerset Light Infantry. And I was delighted, and I wore a green lanyard, and we knew we were going to Germany and that kind of stuff. But in view of the fact that the Durham Light Infantry was very short of officers, and it was customary to switch people around within the Light Infantry group, which was quite normal, and I was, in any case, only a National Service officer, I was put into the Durham Light Infantry, knowing absolutely nothing about Durham County or anything. And I was posted to BAOR, and we went to Dortmund, where the 1st Battalion had just arrived. And I think we did something like 18 months in Dortmund, and then we were posted to Berlin. And at that time, although I was not personally involved, and I don't think it would have meant a great deal to me at the time, we were earmarked for some sort of service of interest. And I think that by then, the Korean War had probably started.
Do you actually remember noticing the start of the Korean War?
Yes, I do, because it was the first thing that the United Nations had done. And I do remember a photograph, which was a standard picture of the Americans standing on the, the first Americans. It wasn't the Marshall picture. Remember, Marshall was when they invaded Seoul or something like that, or further up. But this was a standard picture, like that picture you see of Dunkirk, the ship. And there weren't many people with cameras. And there was one picture of the Americans on the tip of Korea, and this was the big start to the United Nations offensive. But it didn't mean a great deal to us at that time. Probably one or two people might have known that was where we were detailed for if the war had gone on. But we had, I think, something like 2 years in Dortmund and 18 months in Berlin. And I think towards the end of the 18 months, we knew we were earmarked for Korea. But it seemed a long way away because we were first of all going home, where we would do some training in Yorkshire, and we would all have leave and all that kind of stuff. And so there were a few regimental dances, and it was all very exciting. And that's where I met my first wife, as it were, and all that sort of thing. And so the war seemed to be an awful long way away, plus the fact that we knew we were going by sea, which was 8 weeks or something horrific by sea. And so, one was much younger in those days and probably very irresponsible. And of course, you knew that the chaps that you had then, in any case, your men were going to be turning over anyway, so you didn't actually feel that you got your body of men at that time and they would be coming with you to Korea, which was not the case, in fact. You got new people all the time. But that was the start of my army career. And when I was in Berlin, I requested to get a short service commission, which I was granted, because I, at that time, I was... That's right. That's absolutely right, because we knew we were going to Korea. And for some unknown reason, I wanted to go to Korea. And so I volunteered to do a short service commission, and I was granted that. So I had my national service career, then the commission, then I got a short service commission, then I got a regular commission in the fullness of time.
Did any of the other national service subalterns volunteer for short service commission?
Do you know, I can't remember. I think there was thinking about it and talking about it now, there was quite a feeling of excitement. In a very low key, we were very laid back in those days, you know, it was very unsmart to show any enthusiasm about anything. But I think it was likely that one or two people probably, you know, needn't have gone but did. I don't think I could remember further back than that. But I think one or two people could have left and said, well, can I stay on for another couple of months and come out? And I think that's probably what happened. Because generally speaking, we were pretty well under strength. We never had enough officers and never had enough NCOs and that kind of thing. And I would imagine that the commanding officer, Colonel Hanmer, who commanded us in Berlin, didn't unfortunately come with us to Korea. But I think he would have fostered the idea if there were any keen subalterns. I would have thought, yes, quite likely.
You mentioned that you didn't go to Korea with the people you had and your command in Berlin, but presumably there were some regulars in the battalion.
Oh, yes.
It was the 1st Battalion.
Quite so, and of course there's always a regular wastage anyway. But I kept my platoon, so I had two platoon sergeants and at least one NCO, as far as I was concerned, and one or two regular soldiers who were with us in Berlin came with the platoon to Korea.
Do you remember what their attitude was to the news that you were going to Korea?
It's a very interesting question, actually, because looking back on it, there was very little comment, actually. A lot of an interesting thing about that time was that a lot of one's regular NCOs had been in the war, which is quite an interesting point. And you only sort of think about this when you're sort of talking about it like we are now. But most of the senior majors, company commanders, and a lot of the NCOs, sergeant majors, etc., had been in the war. And I think that this was probably the first major excursion, I'm not sure, but I would imagine it probably was, after the war. And a lot of people, I think, you know, treated it as a matter of course, almost. I mean, the downright infantry had fought just about everywhere. And they were pretty sort of tough lot. And the officers particularly, you know, and I thought, well, another year in Korea, you know, it was just taken more or less as for granted. There was no sort of great reaction as far as I can remember. And certainly no political chat. We didn't have that kind of thing in those days.
Where did you do your training when you went back to England?
We went to Yorkshire, and I think it was Filing Day or something like that. I could look it up. But the weather was hot, and we were toughened up moderately, because none of us really had any idea what we were in for. You know, I can't honestly remember anyone coming and giving us a chat about Korea, because I don't think there have been an awful lot of people who had a great deal of experience. But I honestly can't remember that. I imagine that someone must have talked to us. But we did three weeks or 6 weeks or something up in Yorkshire. And of course there was always the thought that the war might be over in any case. You know, no one knew how long it was going to go on, and it could have terminated at any time. So there was always that little bit of uncertainty. And we took it as, you know, we were glad to be home. a lot of us hadn't been home for about 3 years properly. We had our girlfriends and we were seeing our parents, and you know, there was always that little bit of air of excitement about life anyway. But I can't remember anyone coming and giving us a talk, but I think we must have had a few chats. You know, as I say, it is a long time ago. Nothing sticks in the memory. But certainly not a great deal. If it happened, it certainly wasn't a great deal.
What sort of training did you do? Was it purely infantry?
Absolutely the same kind of training that we'd have done at any other time. You know, digging in, platoon attacks, company attacks, battalion exercises, same kind of stuff. There was nothing... We didn't have any experience to, as I say, to, you know, no one has said, look, you've got to dig deep, so let's have a digging exercise. They were Geordies, they dug by nature anyway. And, you know, the training exercises, you dug and then you filled the holes in again. And it was just very good toughening up stuff. But there was nothing specifically geared towards the kind of fighting that we were going to do, which was trench warfare, after all.
Nothing special on fighting in hills, then? Anything like
well,
that?
No, because there weren't any hills on the Yorkshire training areas, you see. And it was just a very good exercise to get the battalion together and get the new people together as well. You know, new chaps coming in, fresh NCOs, new officers, this kind of thing. So when we got to the Yorkshire training bit, that was when, you know, the people were going firm on how long you were going to be in and what you were going to do.
What proportion of the soldiers then were new?
That's a very good question, because quite a lot of them were national servicemen. And there was this iniquity, in my view, that the regular soldiers were paid more than the national service soldiers, which I suppose actually in a peacetime situation was not surprising. But a lot of them, you know, it was a pretty good smattering of new chaps coming in at that time to bring the battalion up to the strength that it should have been, which I believe in those days was about 1,000 men. And I don't think we were ever up to strength. Not that I can remember. I think we may have been 800, 900, that kind of thing. But I don't think we were really ever up to strength.
And how did they take to the idea of going off to the Far East?
Well, I think they accepted it with a certain amount of... You know, they had to do 18 months. I only personally once met any form of aggression against actually having to go into the line. And I think that a lot of the young men were looking forward to it, actually. It was... You see, no one knew quite what was going to happen. I think at least we had that we knew it was going to be hot at times, it was going to be cold at times, and there was going to be an element of danger. But that was about it, really. And I think a lot of chaps were really quite looking forward to it. And I suppose there were the opportunities in the normal course of events for people to opt out if they were, you know, postings within battalions and someone's wanted to go here and go there. And I think those chaps, you know, took it. But, you know, the downright, it was a great regiment, and a lot of comradeship, a lot of people who come from the same pits and all that kind of stuff, and they stuck together, you know.
Were most of your chaps in your platoon miners?
Yes, just about all of them, I think. Or they all came from Durham working class families, and so QED, they were mainly miners, or to do with mining, or... They hadn't actually done anything yet. They lived at home with their mothers. And this was the tough bit, of course. You know, it was probably the first time that an awful lot of them had actually left home. But which one forgot, you know, when one was used to being away from home and this kind of thing. And I imagine it must apply a bit nowadays, too. But certainly, yes, there was a bit of that.
So some of them were homesick?
Well, they didn't show it, but they wanted to get back to their mums. You know, this kind of thing. And they were, what were they, 18? You know.
But I would assume that they would be feeling it as strongly when they were in Yorkshire as they were if they were further away.
Well, yes, probably. The basic training, you see, was very good, which I became involved in in later on. Basic training from the National Service recruit was very good, and that was quite tough. And they had had time to break with the family tie a bit, so actually getting to the battalion was the second leg of the wrench, you know. So it wasn't quite as marked as it used to be when you were up against raw National Servicemen who'd simply just come in, you know, for the first day, this kind of thing.
What was their general state of physical fitness?
It was pretty good. They were all pretty fit. And if they weren't, they were, you know, made to be physically fit. You know, and the army being what I imagine it still is that if you weren't fit, you were out, you know. If you had flat feet or you couldn't see properly, or, you know, you had some deformity, or you limped, or, you know, I mean, there were enough people, really, although there's a contradiction in terms, although we were at times short, there were enough people, and you had to be fit. And so the basic training, you got a fit man, and you knocked him into shape, and by the time he'd done his 3 months, and 3 weeks, or 6 weeks, or whatever it was, in Fylingdales, in the good weather, which we were fortunate to have, and then, of course, we had 8 weeks on a ship, and we did a lot of training on that as well. So at the end of the day, or by the time we got to Korea, you had a pretty good bunch of pretty good fit people.
You mentioned that you were trained specially in using the American Browning 303 machine gun.
This was quite an interesting situation, really, because I was part of support company, and in those days support company was the Vickers machine gun, the 3-inch mortar, and the 2-pounder, which eventually became the 6-pounder, and tank gun. And we were trained latterly in Germany with a 17-pounder. It was an idea that we were given Oxford carriers and 17-pounders to see how the infantry would manage. And I did trials on the 17-pounders in Dortmund, which were very interesting, but the gun was much too big for the infantry. And there was no anti-tank role as such in Korea. That was known by the time, you know, we got there. The war reached its static stage, but there was no anti-tank role. So the anti-tank gun in the position became the tank. And so we, as the anti-tank platoon, had to give up our anti-tank guns and our carriers. And so we should have become another infantry platoon. But someone had the idea that we should train with the American Browning 303. And this we did. We did a crash course in Berlin, and an American came to instruct us. And so we became the Browning machine gun platoon. And I think that this was a little bit of psychology on the part of the commanding officer, because we had trained for quite a long time as a single unit specialist. And I think the men, and I would have been very disappointed to have suddenly found that we were going to be a rifle platoon, but with hindsight, that's clearly what we should have become. We should have become another rifle platoon, and that would be the end of that. Because there was no role for the Browning as a Browning platoon. We should have been switched around the battalion defensive position, as were the Vickers. So you had probably 2 Browning machine guns within a rifle company. That would have been the sensible thing to do. Why this never happened, I honestly don't know. Because at some stage we were how many Brownings did we have? I can't remember now, but I suppose we had 2 to a section, so we had at least 6 and 2 in reserve, so we had something like, say, for sake of argument, 8 Browning machine guns, and they were a pretty good gun. I don't know whether they were better than the Bren. In fact, I think they hotted up more and that sort of thing, but they were more automatic than a Bren gun. You didn't have to change magazines, you had a belt, and that's why, obviously, these things come to you later. But you had boxes of ammunition, and it was a belt, and you just wanged it in, and it was a very good gun. And the 50 the 50 Browning 15mm, I think, is still used, and that was a lethal weapon. But this was its, you know, sort of child, as it were. And so we were a very good defensive rifle come medium machine gun platoon.
How did your men take to it? Must have been entirely new to them.
Well, they took to it very well, because, and that was the psychology in it, that they, you know, having trained for such a long time as an anti-tank unit and learning the skills of shooting at tanks, there was a great deal of sort of enthusiasm, and, you know, you were part of the specialist company and that sort of thing. They say, oh, good, okay, well, we're losing our guns, boys, but we're going to have these things. And so it was a kind of in-battalion snobbery, you know, we're the Browning machine gun platoon. And they took to it very well. It was a kind of sop, you know, and it worked. If indeed our commanding officer thought at the time that this would be quite a good move, he may have done in his wisdom, it worked.
Was it a heavy weapon to carry?
No, it broke into two. You had a tripod and the gun and the ammunition. And I think you could work it on your own. It wasn't like the Vickers machine gun, which I think you needed three people. With the Browning, the only reason you needed another person was because, actually, in answer to your question, yes, you couldn't pick it up altogether and the ammunition. I suppose under pressure you could, but it was combined. The gun and the tripod and the ammunition would be quite a heavy thing, and it was very useful to have someone feeding in the ammunition, so you really needed a team of two, ideally. But it was a portable weapon, and we carried it about a lot. You know, if you took the gun off, you could carry it. It was heavier than a Bren, but it was quite portable.
Was it designed to be a sort of offensive weapon, like the Bren, to go forward with an attacking?
No, I don't think so. I don't know what the logistics of the Browning actually are, but I should think very much defensive. Very much defensive. It had a high rate of fire, from what I can remember, and a good spread. It wasn't anything like as accurate as the Vickers. It didn't have the velocity, it didn't have the range, but it certainly had the spraying power. And, you know, I think possibly in a position where you were being, you know, invaded, rushed at by a lot of Chinamen, I think I'd rather have a Browning than a Vickers, but than a Bren. But I think both of those guns were extremely good.
Could you use this Browning in an indirect role, as with the Vickers?
No, not really. Not with any form of accuracy, because its velocity didn't have the high velocity. It was really, as I say, a defensive weapon against, you know, you could mount it on a carrier, you could stick it on top of a car, anything, that kind of thing. And I think one has seen them in, you know, all these sort of local wars, because of the characteristic casing on the barrel has got holes in it, and there. So it's really an offensive more than you know.
When you were exercising in Yorkshire, did the Browning platoon act as a platoon, or?
Do you know, it's a very interesting question, that, because we didn't have the Browning then. Having done the training in Berlin, we didn't have the Browning because it was an American weapon. I'll check my notes on that, but I'm pretty sure that that's right, that we didn't train with the Browning in England. Having done our bit of training in Berlin, and having been turned from the anti-tank platoon into the Browning machine gun platoon, we became another, I think we did a certain amount of sort of, we probably, do you know, I can't remember whether we did, return to an anti-tank role. I think we probably did, because we were fighting or training as an infantry battalion. QED, you had to have an infantry anti-tank role, and I think that we probably did use the, we reverted. But we didn't have, from what I can remember, I don't think we had the Brownings in England.
When you were instructed in the use of the Browning by the Americans, did they also give you training in tactical employment, or was it purely in the mechanics?
Purely in the mechanics, because it was, as far as the Americans are concerned, a very standard infantry battalion weapon. And I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised to find they had probably six per platoon or something like that. And so there was no question of logistics and that kind of thing that you'd find with the vicars, which were, of course, very complicated and stuff. It was simply how to use it, strip it, clean it, put it together again. And, the ammunition was clipped. I think it was all clipped ammunition. How best to deal with that kind of stuff.
Did you plan to use it in pairs? Or as,
I think it was very much left up to me how I deployed them, and depending on the position we happened to be in at any one time, I think I put the guns where I considered they would be the most useful, as opposed again to the positioning of a Vickers, which is totally different. And I think that depending on whether we were horizontal or lateral to the enemy, it was where you felt that the firepower was going to do most good if you were going to be attacked. And so they were, one dug one's defensive pits and you put your guns in where you thought was necessary.
So it's an ad hoc?
Very much so.
Matter.
We had our Brens as well, you see. We had quite good firepower. But I think it was left... I can't remember the commanding officer ever saying, "Now, where are you going to put your guns?" I think he was quite happy each time when he saw where they were and would ask me, I imagine, why I'd put them there, and it was usually pretty obvious, because it was fairly straightforward, really.
Did you find then that the deployment of your weapons was always determined by the logic of the ground, that the terrain dictated?
Oh, yes. Totally, I would have said. When we arrived in Korea, the war had reached a static stage, as I think is general knowledge, and the last 18 months of the war, and we were there for the last 11 of them, it was a static situation, and it was exactly the same virtually as it had been in the First World War. And I was reading some notes written by Colonel Peter Jeffries, who commanded us, only the other day, that one of the best handbooks, as far as we were concerned, was on how to dig trenches and the defensive position in the First World War. He said there weren't many of those about. But because no one had to dig in, I think I'm getting away from your question a bit, but because no one had to dig in at all, or very little, or to that extent,